This is the Airplane Geeks Podcast. Our aim is to educate and inform you, explore and expand your passion for aviation, and entertain you a little along the way. This episode, we talk about the upcoming Innovations in Flight Family Day and Aviation Display at the Smithsonian's National Air and Space Museum. We have a trip report from an aviation tour of the Pacific Northwest. Micah updates his piece on flight simulation. We have some observations from the D-Day squadron gathering in Connecticut in advance of their trip to Europe for DAX over Normandy. Launchpad Marzari tells us about his personal connection to the Normandy invasion. And we talk about smoke oil used by airshow performers. It's all coming up right now. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 554 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight. We record episodes of this podcast on Mondays, but since Monday this week is Memorial Day, we continue our tradition of bringing you pre-recorded segments from the co-hosts, contributors, and you, our listeners. We call it a Bits and Pieces episode. We hope you'll enjoy what follows. Let's jump right in. We'll start with a conversation I had with our main man, Micah, about the upcoming Innovations in Flight Family Day and Aviation Display, June 15, 2019, at the Smithsonian's National Air and Space Museum, located next to Dulles International Airport in Northern Virginia, just west of Washington, D.C.
Hey, Max. You know, as we're putting this show together, it's about 3 weeks away from what is one of my very favorite days of the year. And, you know, it's not Christmas, and it's not even Thanksgiving. It's Innovations in Flight Family Day and Outdoor Aviation Display, and it's sponsored by our favorite, United Airlines.
You're right, Micah. And, of course, it's always the Saturday before Father's Day, which is June 15th this year, 2019. So Saturday the 15th in June, and the Smithsonian's National Air and Space Museum has again invited the geeks to participate in this wonderful event. I think, Micah, we've been going since about 2011, and that's the first time we met you, I remember, and your mom, Harriet, as well. And it was a great day. And it was also the first time that the hosts on Airplane Geeks had actually met each other.
That was just a wonderful day. And I remember meeting you guys and walking around the museum with Harriet. And at the end of the show, as exhaustive as you guys were, David still took us all on a marvelous, marvelous tour. And Innovations in Flight, I mean, you just got to see it. It's free to the general public, other than there's a $15 parking fee. And the program offers so much to those that go to it. The people at the Smithsonian are just great hosts and offer programs that allow you to explore engineering and design innovations that have taken place during the last century of flight. They let you discover the science behind flight through hands-on. They do STEM-based activities.
Yeah, the activities are great. So if you attend the event, not only do you get to see the exhibits that are always part of the museum there, but they also have additional special exhibitors. And, of course, Airplane Geeks is one of them. But there are others. There are authors and people from different organizations that set up tables around the museum and offer these great experiences to everyone that comes. And not only that, but it is a fly-in of sorts, and they typically have over 50 vintage and modern aircraft on display that fly in and are positioned outside the museum for this event. And it's great because you can walk around, talk to the pilots. Last year, we had a number of pilots that came to the event, including our good friend Hillel Glazier. Dispatcher Mike was there from the Flying in Life podcast. Captain Jeff was there from the Airline Pilot Guy podcast. And Captain, I guess now Major Rick Bell, who was one of the organizers of the Wings Over Pittsburgh show. There's many, many others that were there as well. It was a great experience.
I got to say, if you could make it, if you're listening and you can make it, Innovations in Flight is not to be missed. If you're going to be in the Washington, D.C. area or just want to fly into Dulles on a commercial aircraft for the day, why don't you come and join us? Come see us at Innovations in Flight. It's Saturday, June 15th, 2019. It runs from 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. It's at the Stephen F. Udvar-Hazy Center in Chantilly, Virginia.
And of course, each year after the event, a bit later in the afternoon, usually around 5 o'clock or so, we all get together at the Red Robin in Chantilly for a big meetup and lots of hangar talk. And it's just, oh, I don't know, it's a couple of miles only, or maybe a mile from the museum. So it's very close, very handy. Some people spend the night come in the night before. There are many, many hotels around that area that are quite inexpensive. I think it's pretty easy to find a sub-$100 hotel room if you need a place to stay for the night. But we really look forward to that get-together after the show. You know, it's almost as much fun as the day at the museum itself.
Absolutely. David has organized that for us every year, and he does just a great job. And gosh, you know, I'm really looking forward to seeing you guys and meeting some of our listeners. I'm hoping that they can all be there. So if you're going to be in the area, come on down.
Yes, and bring your family too, because it is a family day in the title. And it's a great event for kids, for other family members that maybe even aren't av geeks the way we all are. It's because the museum and the exhibits, the special exhibits, have so much to offer. So everyone tends to have a great time. So bring your friends, bring your family. Hopefully we'll see you there at the Smithsonian's National Air and Space Museum, Stephen Udvar-Hazy Center. That's located next to Dulles Airport in Northern Virginia.
Can't wait to see you again, Max.
It's always a pleasure to see you, Mike. We're going to put you behind the mic, I think. We'll all be set up with microphones at our table. We'll record some interviews and maybe even get some of you listening to this on the show as well. So we're looking forward to it.
You said family. Is Aunt Benet coming too?
I'm pretty sure that she is.
Great.
If you've listened to the last few episodes, you know that I've recently returned from a week-long trip to Seattle and Victoria and Vancouver, British Columbia. This all started when I got interested in airplanes like the Beaver, Otter, and Twin Otter, utility airplanes used by bush pilots and for float plane service. That led me to Viking Air in Victoria, where I wanted to tour the factory. Well, listener Tom was generous enough to arrange for flights on Alaska Air. Isaac put together an amazing tour itinerary, and listener Bill met us in Victoria to show us the town. Isaac and I did tour Viking Air, and we visited a number of aviation museums and points of interest, plus some non-aviation related sites. It all culminated at the Museum of Flight in Seattle, where we recorded the interviews you heard last week in episode 553. Also at the Museum of Flight, Isaac and I recorded an overview of the trip. Here it is. Well, Isaac, we've had quite a week. It's been a busy week.
Absolutely, Max. We have really traversed the Pacific Northwest for you.
We really have. We started off at the Naval Undersea Museum, not aviation related, not directly.
No, not directly, but very, very cool from that standpoint. The Naval Undersea Museum in Keyport, Washington is one of the official, I believe the Navy has 6 or 7 official museums, and that's one of the two here in the Pacific Northwest, the other being in Bremerton. But yeah, we started out there, and then we kept going up the Olympic Peninsula up to Port Angeles.
Right, Viking Air.
Oh, up and then we took the ferry up then, and then we went to Victoria,
right,
and stuff.
For now. Yes, yeah. The ferry ride was also pretty exciting. But Viking Air was great. There was a big crowd, as it turned out. We thought maybe it was going to be just us, but there was another group. And so there were
– it was about 20 of us and stuff,
yeah,
I believe.
Yeah, it was a big group. They had to break it up into two groups.
Mm-hmm.
But Viking Air did a great job. They had two employees with each of the two tour groups there.
Mm-hmm.
So four employees for an hour or so. That was quite a commitment.
Yeah, that was very good. They took us up It was, in a way, it was kind of similar to the bowling tour here, but on a smaller scale, being for Viking, just right now and stuff, owning two aircraft, but only producing one aircraft model, being the Twin Otter. But we got when you and I entered, they had all 20 of us and stuff or so there, and giving us a brief history of the Viking, the company as a parts supplier, in 2006 or 7, acquiring the DH-1 through DH-7 aircraft up to the Dash-7 aircraft, and then they started the first Dash. The first Twin Otter then came off the line in 2010, and they've been producing them ever since in Suffernet.
The 400 series. The Twin Otter 400 series. Correct. Yeah, it was interesting to me to get to understand sort of their production process, where they have different activities being performed at different locations and things being moved for paint and then coming back and so forth.
Correct, yeah. For the most part, on the manufacturing side, is the wings for the Twin Otter are all produced there in Victoria, and as well as the final furnishing of the aircraft, the interiors and the seats and the avionics, and the cockpit, the front cockpit, right, or flight deck is produced there in Victoria. Then it's shipped up to Calgary. The main fuselage is built out of Wichita, and the tail is actually made outside of Ontario by Fleet, I believe. And some people will correct me. Yeah, Lee Aerospace is the one that makes the fuselage out of Wichita. So and then they make it all, put the plane all together up there. Then it's flown down to Spokane, Washington. It has itself painted, and then it's flown to Victoria here to get its final outfitting of its interiors, and then slide the credit card for the final payment, and you're good to go.
Yeah, yeah. And it's an interesting aircraft, too. Of course, I guess you could characterize the Otter, the Twin Otter, the Beaver, kind of as utility aircraft. They can certainly be configured as bush aircraft, short takeoff.
If you want to compare it with cars, definitely the Ford F-150 type of thing. I mean, go anywhere, do anything from that standpoint. Yeah, they can truly do it all.
And when they developed the 400 model of the Twin Otter, they added a glass cockpit, so that's very modern. I guess they changed the nose.
Yeah, they changed the nose and stuff, so it's more pointed from that standpoint. And then it's newer upgraded engines for
upgraded
more
PT6,
power.
Yeah, Pratt Canada PT6 engines, so it's great. It was nice to go through the factory.
Mm-hmm.
It was not a busy day. We were there on a Friday, wasn't it?
Yeah, well, we found out and stuff. They do three shifts. Technically four shifts, because you had 8 hours. You had a day shift, a swing shift, and then you had a graveyard, and then you had a weekend shift. And that was two 10-hour shifts Monday through Thursday, and then they ran kind of a light Friday one, and then the weekend shift and stuff for things. So, yeah, we didn't hear a lot of banging, riveting and stuff, if you will. They don't use robots yet for putting rivets in the aluminum. They still do it the old-fashioned hand way. So got that. And then we found out, too, during the briefing that, they're shopping around a new updated version of the old Canadair CL. The last one they produced was a CL-415, and they're shopping around seeing if customers want to buy a new 515 aircraft, exclusive water bomber.
I think it's the old one is the 215.
Yeah, the oldest one is the 215, and still radial engines.
Right, that's like a 1967 kind of vintage water bomber, and then the CL-415, the newer version from the newer being 1993.
Yeah.
But it was interesting to see where the aircraft are used around the world. Mm-hmm. And when they plot points on a world map, the Twin Otter has one kind of a distribution, whereas the water bombers have, a
very
band.
Much
a,
yeah, it's, it was like a more of a band and stuff across Canada, being North America. The United States Forest Service doesn't really care to have that type of scoop. There is something that the U.S. Forestry has said that they don't care for that type of water bomber. So they have not used it and stuff for fighting fires that much down here as it has and stuff in Canada.
And popular in Europe, too.
Yeah, very popular and stuff in Europe along the Mediterranean.
Yeah, yeah. So that was interesting to learn more about that. Then they have a multi-purpose version that they're promoting too, the CL-415 MP or multi-purpose that it could be a 19-passenger or a 14-passenger commuter kind of aircraft.
Or it could be commuter, or if it could be more of a true Coast Guard, you know, have more military sensors on that to make sure for, you know, check the shores for drug running, that type of thing as well.
And then they have that that pod, the Guardian version. I guess that's of the Twin Otter,
yep.
But sort of a sensor pod that mm-hmm. would be fitted to the nose, lower portion of the nose.
Correct.
I guess that
yes.
could be used for ISR or those kinds of applications.
And then the U.S. Army is flying that. The U.S. Army was one of the first customers of the Twin Otter when it was relaunched for the 400 series. So then they have, I believe they said three of them had been sold to them.
So it was a great time at Viking Air. After all these years of wanting to do that, it was fun to see the factory and walk through there. They you know, very friendly folks at the Viking Air factory.
Yeah, we had one of the people that was leading the presentation stuff for us was a brand new engineer and stuff in college from that standpoint that was giving me.
Yeah, Blago. He's a student, actually, as you mentioned, in Toronto, University of Toronto, okay. Actually. He's a candidate in the Aircraft Flight Systems and Control Laboratory. He's very well-spoken.
Oh, very, and, very well-spoken.
You know, an intern did a fantastic job, so – after Viking Air, what was next? The BC Aviation Museum?
Yes, that is correct. Yes.
Also in Victoria.
Yep, right there at the airport, just less than half a quarter of a mile stuff down the road from it.
And there we met one of the docents, I guess, mm-hmm. you call her, Connie, who was extremely knowledgeable. She,
that lady and stuff knew her stuff. I love docents and stuff like that who just know the product inside out, or product or the machine.
Yeah, there was almost no question I asked anyway that she didn't know.
Yes.
Yeah, very good. So it was fun to meet her. And then we got to see their documents room, their library.
We went to their kind of library archives.
And that
was probably – they stayed, and I have no reason to doubt them, outside of Ontario and Canada. That was probably one of the largest aerospace aviation libraries I've seen. For that, as well as in the Pacific Northwest. Now, I haven't toured the one place here in the Museum of Flight that we're talking right now that I haven't toured is the actual archives. I haven't done that yet. If the BC one was any taste, that's pretty good stuff here as well. But that BC one was fantastic. For me, uniquely, was I saw there they had the program guides for the Abbotsford Air Show, which is the largest air show here in British, just across the border in British Columbia. And they had the program guide from the very first Abbotsford Air Show I got. I don't remember if I lost my guide, so I took a picture of it and stuff. So that was
– What year was that?
That was 94, 95 did my first Abbotsford Air Show. So I had a – that was a blast that I had. So
it's a pretty extensive library.
Yes.
And there are some items in the library that are generic to mm-hmm. aviation, but what they really kind of focus on is Canadian aviation.
Yeah, yes, they specialize in stuff in that. And what was in one of the interesting things I thought was when the head archivist there was talking to us was that how much of the collection of like duplicates they get of anything
they put up
on eBay, and it was $26,000 they were getting a year.
Yeah, they sold a lot, and that of course helps fund the activities of the museum.
Yeah, it goes right back into the museum. So I thought that was fantastic. Yeah.
Now, we also got up to the Victoria Harbour Tower, the Nav Canada tower.
First off, I want to thank Bill. You know who you are, and
yes.
I cannot thank you enough for being so hospitable to Max and I. He hooked us up with getting a contact, and we got on board the Victoria Harbour Control Tower, which is just to the west of downtown Victoria. And we got, it was a good way. It was a good stair climb up there, wasn't it, Max?
we chose to walk the stairs instead of the elevator, which was maybe a mistake for especially us older folks. But it's interesting because what they're controlling is both water and air.
Mm-hmm.
So the otters, the twin otters, the float planes coming and going. providing transportation for lots of people in this area. Of course, use the same waterways as the boats, pleasure craft, and commercial vessels, and all. So they're controlling all of that.
Yeah. Usually, Victoria is one of the stops for the Alaskan ferry cruises and stuff that start in Vancouver or Seattle. They come and stop there, and then keep heading north and stuff to Alaska. So these cruise ships now are taking about 5,000 people a pop. Usually Victoria only has two at a time that are ported in there. Plus you have all the other standard little water taxis and stuff that are in the area. You have the Canadian Coast Guard that are there, as well as a little bit of the Canadian Navy and stuff is doing stuff there. And then right next door to us is one of the few commercial helicopter operators there, HeliJet, that transports people from Victoria there back to Vancouver, either Vancouver Airport, YVR, or to downtown Vancouver along the waterfront.
And then also in Victoria, we popped into the Royal British Columbia BC Museum.
Yes.
Again, not an aviation museum, but an amazing, amazing museum.
Yeah, very much. It's kind of like if you've been to the Field Museum, your natural history museums, the American Museum in New York, or the Smithsonian Natural Sciences Museum. It's that type of subject content for it.
Yeah.
Just fantastic stuff, seeing the First Nations, which is the Native peoples there in BC, seeing the history of them, seeing the history of wildlife through British Columbia, as well as seeing the European settlements and how they and stuff expanded and grew the population here in the area. So, yeah, fantastic museum. We could easily – we only spent 45 minutes there. If they were open till 6, we would have gladly stayed till 6. But
yeah, we ran out of time.
We ran out of time for that.
After that, on to
– the next day.
Vancouver.
Yep.
On a different ferry.
Mm-hmm.
Great ferry trip. Of course, that's the way you have to get around in this area, either by air – or by ferry,
yep.
Because there's so much water involved, islands and peninsulas and all of that. You can drive a lot of it, except mm-hmm. you can't get to Victoria by automobile. You have to take the ferry.
Yeah, you take the car ferry. And we needed a car to be able to do what Max and I were able to do. We could have rented a car, I suppose. We could have flown Camborair up there. To Victoria, so from its standpoint, it was just easier from its standpoint just to take the car ferries on and off the island, so from its standpoint. But yeah, we landed in Tawasin, which is the ferry terminal south of Vancouver, and then drove into downtown.
Went to the aquarium.
Oh, but before we went to the aquarium, where did we go?
Oh, we had a little automotive diversion.
Yes, we went to right outside the Vancouver Convention Center, and when we went and saw the Vancouver Harbor Flight Center, which is the biggest seaplane operator in the, we'll just say, in Canada, from that standpoint. I know seaplane operators are going to get after me saying the busiest one is in Alaska outside of Anchorage. That is correct. The biggest one in Canada is the Vancouver Harbor Flight Center on the north side of downtown Vancouver. And we saw plenty of activity from the multiple airlines that are over there. Operating there, mostly it's Harbor Air, which also owns some smaller seaplane airlines. Kenmore Air flies there and stuff as well to downtown. Just started last year, actually a year ago. And stuff today is both Harbor Air and Kenmore fly to downtown Seattle to South Lake Union. Can fly up to Vancouver Harbor Flight Center. So from downtown to downtown, that's kind of a very, very unique thing. You don't see many. Big city, big metropolitan cities have direct seaplane services between downtown. So that was fine. So we took some quick pictures there. And then we went over to Stanley Park, which is kind of the central park, the big, huge city park, if you will. Right through it is the Lionsgate Bridge, which is kind of a big, which is Vancouver's Golden Gate Bridge and stuff, for lack of a better term. It's a big green three-lane suspension bridge that was built in the 1930s, and then enjoy the view and stuff from there. And then we got to go to the Vancouver Aquarium.
Yeah, that was wonderful. I always like the jellyfish in this place. I don't know why. They're just so bizarre.
And they're so peaceful. It's kind of serene. Yeah. It's just it's very, very nice and stuff, seeing all those.
Yeah. I have a hard time believing that anything clear could really be alive. You know,
that's a good point. It's stuff.
It just seems so strange. Yeah, it's weird.
Yeah, where's the brain or any? Yeah. You know, the digestive tracks and stuff and anything. They just don't appear, and it's just that is a living creature, but it's totally different than what a human being and stuff is composed of. So,
along the way, we were kind of in a city street, but a side street, and we saw a Lamborghini parked on a corner. And then noticed that it was sitting outside of a Lamborghini dealership. So we decided we had to stop for that. And then while we were getting out of the car, we noticed that across the street was a McLaren dealer. So
we made an executive decision. We were going out and we were going shopping for supercars.
That's right. That's right. And and I can now say that I've sat in the seat of a $400,000 automobile McLaren.
And I can assure you, everybody, he was grinning from ear to ear.
Yeah. And I thought they were going to throw us out, you know, because I made it clear when I went in there and was approached by the salesperson that I was not going to become a customer, but they didn't mind at all. They said, "Here, let me open the door, help yourself, get inside the car, take as many photos as you want." And it was wonderful. They had a lot of them too. They had about a dozen, maybe.
Yeah, there was a dozen McLarens there. Yeah.
And then we went over and looked at the Lamborghinis.
Yep. And then, there was a Ferrari dealership as well. We didn't go to there, so we just stuck with the two of them. But then found out from the Lamborghini. In the city of Vancouver, from my going out there since the early 90s and stuff, it's a city that is very comfortable with flaunting your wealth. And so, when I used to go up there when I was in college throughout the years to the city, it was never a strange thing to see, $300,000 on up, cars of any type driving the street. You at least see a couple of them.
Yeah.
And we found out from the dealer and stuff, he sells, the Lamborghini dealer, they sell about 130 cars a year. That's a lot. And these are cars that are like $500,000 on up. And that's the cheapest one and stuff is $500,000. So
yeah, it's pretty impressive. So I know this is sounding a little bit like a travelogue, but
in a way it is,
but that's fine. That's okay. We had a great time. After that,
we went to Granville Island, which is kind of like, if you've been to Seattle, it's Vancouver's Pike Place Market. In a sense, it's a huge food market, but they also sell a bunch of flowers, arts and crafts. There's comedy clubs. There's a bunch of little smaller museums there, funky artworks, street performers. I mean, it's just a fun collective that's in the city, and it's just a great place to stuff to just park the car and just walk around for the day.
Yeah. For days and days, probably. I think you could.
Well, Max, what was the street comedian that we saw that was doing? What was the stunt that he was doing?
Oh, he was up on he had a board across a
roller,
a roller or a piece of a pipe or something, and he was. I guess. Well, we didn't get there at the beginning, but I guess he was taking a tennis racket that had the strings removed, and it was passing it. Over, starting through, with his head and getting all the way down to the last foot out through it.
And without falling,
which he did. But, so I think after that, maybe we got back into some more aviation stuff, right? At the Canadian Museum of Flight.
Yep, we went to the Canadian Museum of. Before that, and so that night and stuff, we went to the Angry Beaver or to the Flying Beaver.
Oh yes, the Flying Beaver,
which we missed and stuff the previous night when we were in Victoria. We had gone to the Flying Otter. These are restaurant restaurant chains that are affiliated with Harbor Air, which is the largest seaplane operator in North America. They run two restaurants, the one in Victoria Harbor and the one which is the Otter and the Beaver that is at its home just south of Vancouver International Airport, or YVR for short. And had a great meal, nice atmosphere and stuff there with things. That was great from that standpoint.
Yeah, definitely candidates for the eatattheairport.com.
Oh, absolutely.
Database, yeah, for sure.
So then the next day we went to, when we started heading back south here to Seattle, drove east to Langley, Canada, and that's where the Canadian Museum of Flight is located. And I had never been there before. from that standpoint, didn't know what to expect. And a very nice little comfortable little museum for things. They had it was amazing the amount of engines that they had there, from old Merlins to Wrights to what were some of the other ones and stuff that we were seeing? Some
almost
the, small, you know, Pratt, small Pratt, I mean, radios, Pratt, yeah. GEs and stuff. But there was a couple other manufacturers I didn't even recognize and stuff that were around the World War II era. Of course, being a Canadian museum and stuff, they had to have a little exhibit about the Arrow.
Yes, of course.
I love you, Canada and stuff. I get it with the Arrow. You're very proud of that. But yeah, you guys have a lot of other aerospace things that are really cool too.
When we were talking earlier with Amy about preservation of items at a museum, she mentioned the issue of sometimes items are outside and subject to the elements.
Yes.
And that was the case here. They have this very limited space, no funds or insufficient funds to build some additional capacity, inside capacity. So they had a lot of – well, they had a number of aircraft, but also a lot of engines and other items just really out in the elements and subject to an awful lot of corrosion, which was, you know, kind of a shame. But you could really see what Amy was talking about, the need to protect these things. Otherwise, you know, they corrode away or dissolve away or fade away or whatever. And a lot of museums, aviation museums, just don't have the resources to ensure the preservation of these items. So it's a real issue, a big issue.
Yes. So we did there. One of the cool things I saw when I was there was I looked at a model and I was like, is that a Boeing, the Boeing Supersonic 270? And sure enough, it was. Canadian Pacific apparently had ordered that type, and it was in its livery type of thing. So I was like, wow.
Yeah, interesting things you see at some of these little museums.
Then after there and stuff, we headed back across the border. It was a half hour wait and stuff for there, so not too bad, you know, not too outlandish stuff for that. Then we took a little drive down Chuckanut Drive, which is a very scenic drive along the Washington coast here, and then you can see the San Juan Islands to the west. And then we made it down to Payne Field and to a museum, the one museum around the Pacific Northwest I had still not been to, and that was the Historic Flight Foundation, which is run by John Sessions, who is the founder and as well as a pilot for that, and got to see his collection of World War II aircraft.
And these are immaculately restored and preserved.
Oh, yes.
And these airplanes look really, really good. And they're all flyable.
Yeah, and everything and stuff in there is flyable, and as well as some of the buses that there was a bus, and then there was a fire truck or a Jeep and a Jeep and stuff that was in there as well.
Right, part of the collection.
And part of the collection and stuff from that era.
Yeah.
Because I believe in stuff, the Historic Flight Foundation focuses on the beginning of flight to like the Wright brothers until the beginning of the jet, basically the Comet. Mm. So whenever the Comet came out, I believe in 50. You know, I know all the Brit and France are listening to this are going to scream at me saying the year and stuff right now, but let's just say early 50s. So, Peter, yes, I know you're going to correct me.
Yeah, that was a really impressive, impressive collection. John Sessions wasn't there because at the time, as we visited and as we record this now, he is in
somewhere probably over Mississippi, the Mississippi Indiana River, and stuff from that standpoint.
Working to Connecticut for the D-Day squadron,
which you'll be able to see here in 2 days' time.
Yes, yes. But we also saw some interesting aircraft outside through the fence. We saw nice.
So we kept seeing. I kept seeing Max and Maxes, and kept seeing Maxes, and Max. I'm not used to seeing more than one Max. When I'm up at Payne Field, but apparently the Boeing, unfortunately, with the issue and stuff with the MAX, having the two crashes that have happened, not being able to deliver any to customers right now. Well, the Boeing company is trying like crazy to find any open space here in the Puget Sound region to park the planes.
Yeah, because they're still coming off the line.
Yes, they're still coming off the line. They reduced the production rate now down to it was up at 52, and I believe they reduced it now temporarily to 42. Hmm. So the suppliers now, specifically GE as well as Spirit and Wichita and other suppliers and stuff for various components can catch up. Yeah, they're parking them like crazy everywhere. And the Renton Airport is filled up. Boeing Field here is filled up. And now Payne Field and stuff is getting filled up. So I'm wondering what the next airport will be that they will start doing it, whether it's Moses Lake, whether it's Portland, or they'll start the other popular – you know, a popular idea would be to go send them down to Victorville, where that's a usual paint hanger sometimes that Boeing uses for new planes before they're delivered as well. So we shall see from that standpoint. But it's definitely eye-opening seeing how many planes – but it's not only just Maxes that are – a lot of them that are parked up there. Mm. What else did you see up there that was parked a lot there, Max?
You saw the tankers.
Yes. United States Air Force just started accepting the tankers here at the end of January, but unfortunately we've had two stoppages because of FOD issues, that tools were being found inside the planes after they've been delivered to the Air Force. So now they're being accepted again to the Air Force, so hopefully no more issues with that.
Yeah, but there were quite a few of them parked around in a couple of locations. And we drove up to Everett for just a quick stop.
Yeah, that's where Payne Field is at.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
For that. So, but, yep. And it came home, and that was the day, except from that standpoint. Sorry.
And then now the Museum of Flight, where we are now, which feels good to come back to after being here, what, 3 years ago, was it?
Yes, sir. It was April 2016. You were last year.
Yeah, for the Geek Fest for that year, which was a fantastic experience. And so we have some interviews from the Museum of Flight that we'll be having for you. Or actually, I think you will have heard them already by this point.
Yes.
Fantastic hosts to Isaac and myself here at the Museum of Flight. Definitely, a must-visit kind of destination.
Yeah, because the last time you were here, the one big thing that was not open at the time was – it was still under construction – was the aviation pavilion that houses all the first Boeing 727, 707, 737, 47, the 787, and then the Concorde. So – so it's been a great trip and stuff so far, Max.
Fantastic. Yeah. I'd like to thank Tom for initially kicking this off and making this possible. Really appreciate it. This has been just an amazing time. Also, of course, Bill, as you mentioned, Isaac, was a fantastic host at Victoria. Got to see a lot of the town, a lot of the sights. And boy, I'm ready to go back. That's what a great place.
Victoria and Vancouver as well are just a fantastic place to visit. Yes.
And of course, I want to thank you, Isaac, for being the ultimate Uber Av geek and setting up so much of this.
Well, I'm happy. I'm happy always to share a trip and with a passion with someone else who's a fellow, just has a passion for aerospace and aviation. So it's fun to always do these things for things. So, yes, you're tired from doing everything, but I'm also energized at the same time doing it. So.
Yeah, you've just been wonderful. Very kind and really appreciate it. It wouldn't have been possible without you, Isaac. So, again, thank you for that.
Happy to do it.
And so I think that will be it for us for this trip. We're not doing – this is it, right? We're going to get something to eat for dinner.
Yeah, we're going to sit something to dinner, and we might meet somebody else that you might hear later, but we don't know stuff if that's going to work yet. So I won't announce it, who that could be for that. But other than that, we're going to go Max is going to tour the rest of the museum that he hasn't toured yet. We really both enjoyed the Destination Moon, being able to see that. And if you can come out to Seattle this summer, specifically July around the festivities to actually celebrate the 50th anniversary of the moon landing, Seattle is the epicenter.
Yeah.
And I cannot recommend enough coming out here. If you want to make a trip out this summer, come to that.
I want to thank Sean Mobley at the Museum of Flight for making their podcast booth available for us to record the interviews and my conversation with Isaac. And again, if at all possible, you owe it to yourself to visit the Museum of Flight and see the Destination Moon, the Apollo 11 mission exhibit. Again, it's open through September 2nd, 2019. The museum's website is museumofflight.org. And be sure to listen to their Flight Deck podcast. And we'll have a link to that in the show notes, or you can find it at the museum's website.
Hello, airplane geeks. Reporter-at-Large Launchpad Mazzari. Here at the Airplane Geeks, we have featured ongoing stories and followed along with our listeners getting their pilot's license, glider rating, and instrument ticket. Well, in that spirit, I invite you to come along in a new series as your reporter-at-large wanders down the taxiway to buy an airplane. Join me over the next couple of weeks as we head down the runway to see what it's like to be part of the first two letters of AOPA, aircraft owner. So stay on this frequency. More to follow.
All right. Well, we can't wait to hear what that's all about and just what airplane Launchpad is looking to purchase. Well, now we have our main man, Micah, with a refresh on a piece we played way back in episode 277.
Thanks, Max. So I wrote this piece back in December of 2013, and it first appeared on Airplane Geeks episode 277. But based on the issues with the 737 MAX, another story, as David put it, just won't die, I think it's still quite pertinent. This piece has been updated some, but if you heard it before, it will sound familiar, although the questions still linger. A few years ago, I attended a live musical concert when the Portland Brass Quintet, combined with the Maine Chamber Ensemble, came together to perform a program called Musical Fireworks. It was the first time I'd been to a live concert in many years, and it was so beautiful that at times it moved me to tears. I was listening to live music composed by Rossini and Mozart, in just the way they imagined they would always be heard. Now, I'm neither a composer nor a musician, but I'm a music lover and an audiophile. I love music almost as much as I love airplanes, but I don't listen to it very much anymore. At one time, I owned a high-end sound system, but I replaced it a few years ago with a small soundbar. I used to go to live concerts regularly, sometimes 3 and 4 times a week, but that stopped too. Why did I give up listening to the music I love? The reason is I'd realized that most of the time I wasn't listening to music. I was listening to music simulation. While this may come as a shock to you, the majority of the music we hear these days comes through a speaker. That's true even when we go to an allegedly live performance. The sounds we hear almost always come through a speaker. Think about it. When was the last time you heard music from its point of origin directly to your ear that was not coming through an electronic device of some sort? If you think about it long enough, you may come to realize that you yourself, or maybe people you know, have never, ever heard true live music. Now, although music simulation has improved tremendously since Thomas Edison first made a recording on a wax cylinder, it's still a simulation. Simulated music has gotten so good, in fact, that in some cases, certain music can't be created without it. Some musical instruments are only musical simulations. Examples include solid body guitars, Rhodes pianos, Moog synthesizers, the theremin, too many to name. The same is true for some musical styles. Hip-hop, techno, and electronica are all examples of genres that would not exist without the music being simulated or sampled. In these cases, the simulation has become the reality. But how can people, who may have never actually heard real music, know what they're simulating? When I worked as a road manager for acoustic singer-songwriters, some of my biggest challenges included working with sound engineers at live venues. There were many times that I had to explain that what the performer needed was for the sound to be invisible, not visually, but acoustically. The job of the soundboard operator was to make the room sound like the microphones, amplifiers, and speakers didn't exist. Often, they just didn't understand me because they had never really heard a naked guitar or voice before. As I said before, I'm neither a composer nor musician, but I am a music lover and an audiophile. I'm also not a pilot, and I'm not an engineer, nor am I in any way involved with aviation, other than being an airplane geek. This leads to what may be naive questions. Has simulation become the reality in aircraft design and piloting? What would be the reality? Well, Kelly Johnson didn't rely on a computer to design the P-38, F-104, or the SR-71. Would he have designed better aircraft with computer simulation? Possibly. The odds are it would have assisted him with his natural flair for engineering and design. Bob Hoover didn't learn to fly in a simulator. Well, maybe he flew a Link trainer, but he didn't need a flight simulator to be a great pilot. Would a modern simulator have improved his piloting skills? Who's to say? Chuck Yeager, a great pilot who understood engineering, and Jack Ridley, a great engineer and a pilot, working together, figured out that the X-1 needed a flying tail in order to break the sound barrier. Again, modern technology probably would have been a great help to them, but they knew what it was to fly and design a naked airplane. Of course, just like with Edison and his wax cylinder recordings, we have come a long way in aircraft computer modeling and flight simulation. But don't we still need to really fly airplanes to truly understand performance? Computer simulation in aircraft design is a great tool, but there are flaws. Look at the delays during the rollouts of the A380, the 787, the development problems with the F-35 and KC-46. Think about the in-flight, non-contained engine failure of the Rolls-Royce Trent 900 on Qantas 332, the battery issues with the 787. Yes, simulations can help, but they're simulations, not reality. If you don't know what reality is, how can you design and model an accurate simulation for it? This seems to be especially true most recently when it comes to the MCAS of the 737 MAX. Its full name, Maneuvering Characteristics Augmentation System, seems to define itself as simulation, and it uses computer modeling to supplement the flying characteristics of the aircraft, and was designed in such a way as to not even inform pilots it was taking away their hand control. Of course, this is close to being fully corrected now, and I'm sure the 737 MAX will go on to be a great aircraft. But do you see how flight simulations may be the origin of the problems? Maybe doing a Tex Johnston barrel roll in a Dash 80 is a bit over the top. But is it truly unreasonable to expect that A330s or 777s be put through power on and power off stalls during testing? Are we teaching pilots how to fly simulators and program flight decks, rather than how to hands-on fly? Could this lack of knowledge and inexperience with hands-on flying have been contributing factors to Air France 440 and Asiana 214? Are we so sure that simulators are so accurate that we don't even need to tell pilots about software overrides of flight controls? Is it computer modeling and not real flying that led to Lion Air 610 and Ethiopian 302? With computer models and simulations, engineers can almost definitively predict an outcome. And I'm a firm believer in probabilities, statistical analysis, mathematics, and sampling. But is the code for simulators and pilot training based on faulty or simulated data? Is almost definitively enough? In some cases, it seems we have no real data at all. Perhaps just like with music, simulation has become the reality for flight training and aircraft design. But how can a sound engineer who has never heard a live acoustic guitar make it sound live in a room full of people? How can aircraft designers or pilots who have never recovered from a real stall be expected to fly upwards of 400 souls through a real potential disaster? Life is not a simulation. For the Airplane Geeks, here in Portland, Maine, this is your main man, Micah.
As you no doubt know by now, this year is the 75th anniversary of D-Day, the invasion of Normandy in World War II. Big commemoration activities are planned for Europe, including DAX over Normandy, where C-47s and other aircraft will recreate paratrooper drops. The North American contingent of these World War II planes is called the D-Day Squadron. Many of those aircraft assembled at the Waterbury-Oxford Airport in Connecticut before beginning their journey to Europe. I was fortunate enough to take a press ride in Placid Lassie, a beautiful C-47 that was originally delivered to the U.S. Army Air Forces in 1943. Placid Lassie participated in D-Day as well as other actions during the war. After the war, Placid Lassie had a number of different civilian owners, but is now owned and operated by the Tunison Foundation. She's equipped to carry paratroopers and flies at aviation events around the country, including EAA Air Venture at Oshkosh. Now, I have a couple of impressions from my formation flight around Connecticut in Placid Lassie. First, it's loud. You'd expect that from a military aircraft with no insulation or pressurization. Crouching next to a window, bouncing around, and seeing other airplanes in close proximity is a new experience for me. It's pretty cool. And finally, riding in a C-47 made me reflect on the very young soldiers flying off to war and facing an uncertain future 75 years ago. It was kind of emotional. They were truly the greatest generation. So I actually tried to make some recordings in Placid Lassie. First, the engine run-up, and then the takeoff. We did have a jump master on board, and you'll hear him yell out the jump calls. Now, I'm not sure how well this will work. There are some quiet parts when the engines were throttled down, and some much larger parts when the engines were under full power. So don't turn up the quiet parts, because you might get blasted when those rotary engines start making a lot of noise.
This plane is based here, isn't it?
It goes between here and New Smyrna Beach, Florida.
Oh, that's right.
We keep it down in Florida mostly.
Okay.
But yeah, it does. It's the second home is here.
Yeah, that's what I thought, yeah.
So when they do jump, what altitude do you usually jump from?
Anywhere from 1,250 feet to 2,500 feet. The norm is between 1,250 and 1,500.
Okay.
And on rare occasions, if the winds are kind of weird, we'll drop down to 1,000, but never below 1,000. Even though you can do it, we don't do it.
To take
what they're doing is they're blades and the props.
Next, I attempted to record a little piece in flight. I could hardly hear myself speaking. And then I came to realize that we were in a formation flight. So, as you'll hear, my interest quickly shifted from making a recording to taking my first air-to-air photographs.
This is Max Flight reporting aboard the Placid Lassie C-47. Boy, it's noisy in here, let me tell you. I guess this is the first time I've been in an aircraft of this vintage. Certainly one without any lack of noise-deadening material. It's a beautiful aircraft, nicely restored. They've got a few rows of, well, their former airplane, or rather airline seats fastened to the floor for passengers. We're behind the wing. I'm sitting behind the wing, aft of the wing. Ahead of us is two large fuel tanks. I don't know what size these things are. Maybe, I don't know, 400, 500 gallons, maybe, a piece. They're bolted down to the floor. They're right over the center section of the wings. And, boy, we were kind of bouncing around a little bit. But we're having a great time. Behind me, one of the crew here is a jump master. And he went through the actual calls that he would give for a real jump. You got to have good lungs to be a jump master in a C-47 because I'll tell you, it's pretty noisy. I don't know how the jumpers would hear you, at least those up front. So he uses hand signals as well, and I guess that's probably what they're really watching is the hand signals rather than listening to his voice. So we're flying over the Connecticut countryside. We left up to the north. We're going to meet up with other aircraft, other C-47s, and a couple of DC-3s. And we're actually going to fly in formation. I can see three other 47 C-47s out the window right now, plus the lead aircraft, the DC-3. I anticipated a press ride, but didn't anticipate that we'd actually be flying in formation. All right, I'm going to take some shots. Sort of hard to take pictures when you're bouncing around like this, but oh my God, I have never been this close to another airplane in the air. It's really spectacular. Holy moly. Yeah, we are close. We are very close. Yeah, very spectacular. I'm going to see if I can get some photos. Maybe we'll come back in a little bit, but this is a really exciting moment.
AvWeb has a nice video titled D-Day Squadron's Departure Prep for Normandy, and we'll have that in the show notes at airplanegeeks.com/554. The D-Day Squadron website is ddaysquadron.org, and you can find the DAX Over Normandy site at daxovernormandy.com. I also created a photo album. You can find that at airplanegeeks.com/ddaysquadron. You can have a look at that. Also, I forgot to mention, there's also a photo album of my Pacific Northwest trip. You can find that at airplanegeeks.com/PacificNW. It's got photos from both the aviation and non-aviation destinations, including some $400,000 exotic cars in Vancouver. I texted my daughter that I was seriously contemplating spending her inheritance right then and there on a McLaren, but thought better of it in the end. Our Airplane Geeks reporter at large, Launchpad Merzari, has a personal connection to the D-Day invasion. Let's listen as he tells us the story.
In the next 2 weeks, we will celebrate the 75th anniversary of the D-Day invasion to liberate Europe. I have several personal connections with this event, and I'd like to share them with you. As a member of the Commemorative Air Force, I have contributed to the restoration of That's All, Brother, and other C-47s, especially those here in Texas. Two members of the Liberty Jump Team are friends of mine, and they are also members with me in my home squadron, the B-29 Fifi Squadron of the CAF. But my connection goes a little deeper than this. Set your clocks for late 1944, where a young company commander, one First Lieutenant Guy Marzari, comes back from the briefing to tell his soldiers, "Pack your bags, boys. Where you're going, you won't need them." In those days, you had an A bag and a B bag. Your A bag held your dress screens, your khakis, your low-quarter shoes, and other garrison sundries. Your B bag held all your tactical equipment. They were ordered to mail back their A bags because, as we all know, what happened several days later on June 6th, or as near as I can trace it back from my father, the night of June 8th, they weren't going to need garrison equipment. Advance the clock 49 years. My father and I are cleaning our grandmother's house after her death. In the attic in the far back, I pull out an old OD bag, and my father says, "Hey, it's my A bag." We open up the bag, to which my father yells, "Hey, that's where the damn thing went." The top item inside the bag is a notebook. We open the notebook, and there's my father's D-Day invasion map. Yes, my father had inadvertently placed the notebook in the bag, then zipped it shut and mailed it home. The notebook contained my father's classified D-Day invasion map. My father ended up going ashore without his map. This map is now framed and hanging in my office. Before I had it framed, though, an associate of mine at the National Reconnaissance Office made a high-density scan of the map for the NRO records. I gave one of these high-density prints to my friends on the Liberty Jump Team, who will make the ceremonial jump this June 6, 75 years later, into Normandy, but they will have an exact replica of the map used. The drop zones are not on the map as they are further inland, but they will be able to use it when they visit the beach. Now, listeners, history is meant to be shared. So if you go to the show notes for this episode, we will make available a JPEG version for you to download of the D-Day invasion map. Note, it is still classified top secret and has never been declassified. Don't tell the Germans we're going to invade. You will also note that due to the laser scanning technique, in the ocean part, you will see the map legend on the back side of the map, which is printed in red and bled through during the scanning process. Now you have a connection to the 75th anniversary of D-Day and a reason to follow the Dacs as they return to Normandy. This has been your reporter at large, Launchpad Marzari, frequency change approved. Good day.
Thanks for the story, Launchpad. Visit the show notes at airplanegeeks.com/554 to see a photo of the invasion map in Launchpad's office. If you click that photo, you'll see a high-resolution image of the map itself. It's a 20-meg file, so while it is quite large, the detail is pretty amazing. A few episodes ago, we wondered what smoke oil was all about. I mean, the stuff that airshow performers use to generate that white smoke that enhances their performances. Well, not unexpectedly, we got some good feedback from you, our listeners, and in fact, we talked about it last week, but we cut it from the last episode to try and shorten what was already too long. So here's what we said about smoke oil. In the past, was it last episode where I confessed my ignorance of smoke oil?
Me too. I didn't know anything about it either.
Yes. Well, we heard from a couple of listeners. We heard from Hangar 732 in the Slack team, and also Andrew posted a comment on the website under episode 552. So we have some interesting resources. We have the Aeroshell Smoke Oil Data Sheet. It's a PDF. It gives all the specifications for it, but they note that the Aeroshell Smoke Oil is a hydrocarbon fluid based on shell gas to liquid technology.
It says it's fully saturated with a high degree of isoparaffinic structures, whatever that means. I don't know what that means. And then we also have a piece from Water Aviation. This is Smoke Oil, the Essence of Every Air Show. And in that, they say that smoke is produced by pumping biodegradable paraffin-based oil directly onto the hot exhaust nozzles of piston engines or the exhaust fumes of jet engines, and the oil is instantly vaporized into a thick smoke. It says a similar effect may be produced by special generators with an external power supply system. For best visual experience, very efficient multi-nozzle systems are used. Nowadays, using this type of equipment to produce smoke during an aerobatic shows is a must. It is, of course, possible to simplify the whole system by burning the oil into a combustion chamber, which is what I kind of thought it was, but the smoke would then be black. And so if you wonder, so where was smoke oil used first? Well, here they say that it was the Black Cats. They were the first aerobatic team that used a smoke effect, and that was 1957 at Farnborough. Also, on the safety issues, they say it's not easy to make smoke oil suitable for air shows. Safety must come first. The smoke oil cannot be toxic. It should be biodegradable and should have appropriate density to fully vaporize. During an air show, everyone in the public comes in contact with the smoke oil when it covers the ground in a thick layer. That is why safety issues need to be given the highest priority. So there's a little bit more about smoke oil. And thanks to Hangar 732 and Andrew for passing that great information along. And we'll have links to both the technical data sheet and the Water Aviation article in the show notes.
And there's one part of that that I can't quite figure out. When is smoke oil covering the ground in a thick layer? I mean, to me, that would be if you spilled it, for example. But other than that, I can't imagine why you'd have a thick layer of it on the ground.
Have you ever seen Sean Tucker go screaming down at about 50 feet off of the deck?
Okay.
I think it leaves a fog.
It leaves a wall of, yeah. That wall of smoke, if it's blowing the wrong way, blows directly over the audience.
Okay.
Yeah. That's the way I kind of thought of it too. Yeah. The way it's worded, you're right though, Max, it kind of sounds like a layer on the ground or a oil on the ground, but I think you're talking about the fog of the smoke on the ground.
Smoke on the water.
Yeah.
A fire at Oshkosh.
Well, that's it for this Bits and Pieces episode. We hope you enjoyed it. Next week, we'll return to our normal format. Don't forget to visit eatattheairport.com. It's our crowdsourced map of airports where you can find a place to eat, often right at the airport. Whether you're flying in for a $100 hamburger or driving past on a road trip, we encourage you to support these airports and eating establishments with your business. At last check, there were 374 airports listed. That's at eatattheairport.com. And we'd like to thank those of you who submitted revisions to the database. This really is crowdsourced, so your input helps keep it relevant. As always, please help promote the Airplane Geeks podcast wherever you can, on social media, at work, at your flying club, wherever. We'd be very grateful. You can find us at airplanegeeks.com. Show notes for this episode at airplanegeeks.com/554. We encourage you to subscribe to the podcast so you don't miss any episodes. You can subscribe in Apple Podcasts on iOS, in Google Podcasts on Android, or through the podcast app you use on your mobile device. We also have an option for those of you who like to go old-fashioned and want an email whenever a new episode is published. There's a very easy way to do that. Just visit subscribebyemail.com, type in Airplane Geeks, and then with each episode you'll receive an email that includes an embedded audio player. Our outro is by Bruno Massone. Find more of his music compositions that incorporate aviation sounds at brunomassone.com. So please join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Ladies and gentlemen.